Hi.
Hello. It's Matt again. What's up? I saw one more hole in the list of lectures that you have for this course. And again, it's because this Kwame Nkrumah text is something that I have added into the course since I last taught it online. So I'm going to supplement right here by talking some about Kwame Nkrumah and why I've included him and, you know, what can we learn from him. Now, this is maybe a kind of weird text, you might think, to have in a class which is focused on the question of values, what we think is good, and who is giving us these senses of good and thereby controlling directly or indirectly, well, I guess in this case indirectly, our actions. It might seem weird to shift over and to be reading a revolutionary leader from Africa in Ghana from 1968. How do we get there? Well, there's really tight connections. First of all, let's just recognize that we are zooming out. Like a lot of the stuff that we've looked at, we've thought about it in terms of our own context, right? Like our situation here in this school, in this city, in this state, in this country, right? And with figures like Edward Said, we're thinking about the relationships between this sort of insular national space that is produced for us by schools and media and so on, and the outside, and the way that the outside is falsified. Now we're moving our view to look at the outside and to hear from the outside. And so I think one of the things that Nkrumah gives us is simply a basic understanding of how the world order really works. You know, we're not generally told this. We're led to believe that there are, you know, 180-some independent nation states, and like they've always existed and they're just natural. We don't really look at how the nation states were constructed in many cases. And, you know, like since World War One or World War Two, in Europe, even, you know, like Italy wasn't a nation state until the late 1800s. We don't think about how the nation state has a history and how that's not how people have always been organized. And another thing that we don't think about because it's hidden from us is how not all nation states are equal, right? We know that. And we've got a part of our ideology that tells us, you know, the United States is the greatest country that's ever existed and blah, blah, blah. And then we have these kind of like, you know, weird debates about like whether we put it in code language. We're talking about imperialism, but we don't know that we're talking about imperialism. So we'll talk instead about, you know, whether the United States should play police for the rest of the world, because we're like taking it for granted that the United States is somehow like morally superior and culturally superior, that it's like a more advanced civilization, that it represents freedom and progress. We'll take all that sort of stuff, which is like the biggest, you know, load of ideological pretense. You know, like those are all they're all untrue, but they probably couldn't be true of anywhere in the world, right? Like they're just like notions. They're not realities. The world doesn't really like work like that. Like it's not that nation states are moral. Nation states like hold down labor and resources and make them available to capital, and they make war against one another, and they make war all over the world. And the more powerful they are, the more they make war, right? They're not just like moral progressive enterprises. Anyway, most of us are satisfied or numbed and dulled enough to the point where we don't ask about the real order. But Nkrumah does, because he is in a position where he is having to fight against these major imperial powers. He's in Africa, and yet he still understands that in 1968, the primary enemy of African independence and liberation is the United States. It's our country. Right, so I think it's important to get the big world picture that he gives us, and then we can go on and say, and hey, look, a bunch of the things that happen in this big world picture, they're also happening in our situation here. And the things that we've learned about, you know, like propaganda and ideology and dominant ideology and causing, you know, hegemony, causing people to think along certain lines so as to control them, that happens on a global scale, not just a national and a local scale, right? It's like the collective West is engaged in psychological warfare against most of the rest of the world. Or if you don't like that language because it sounds too combative or pushy or something, there exists a large-scale media and therefore cultural influence of the collective West, and especially the United States, upon most of the rest of the world. Just look at what movies do they watch? What TV do they watch? What are their news sources? What are the primary news channels, and who owns them? You know, Nkrumah is pointing at that stuff. Those are objective facts about the world. But if you look carefully at the agreements that these powerful governments like ours, or the government together with the capitalists whom it represents, what kind of agreements do they make with places like Ghana? It can include literal political agreements to have a monopoly over media flows, right? Like, that's not just some kind of, like, you know, transactional accidental fact. That's an aspect of domination. And if you don't want to call it that, it's because you're uncomfortable thinking about how you or we are dominated, and uncomfortable thinking about the fact that we might need to fight back, and that maybe, like, the people who we've been told are our enemies, you know, the revolutionaries and the so-called warlords in the so-called third world, that maybe actually they are noble people engaged in a very a defensible struggle, and that maybe we owe them some support, and that if we're right here in the center of the beast, in the center of imperial power for the whole globe, maybe we actually have some kind of responsibility to do something about that. If you don't like those feelings, then you can easily shift over to just saying that none of this stuff counts, doesn't matter, I don't want to hear it. And you know, I just point out that you've been trained to not want to hear it, and you only live once. Do you really want to have, like, a false view of the world and pass that on to your children? Like, who benefits from a false view of the world? You know, if you teach your kids things that just are objectively false, is that going to lead them to do better or worse in life? Don't we, like, benefit from really telling the truth about things? So, okay, Nkrumah talks about imperialism. Let's define that. Imperialism and capitalism are inseparably linked. Marx thought this. Lenin really codified this in a book called On Imperialism, which I still, that was 1917. I still see people working from the definitions that you can find in Lenin about imperialism. And I also have found very similar things in years before Lenin published from W.E.B. Du Bois defining imperialism in this way. Imperialism is just capitalism turned outward from a nation state. Internally, capitalism is a structure which depends upon a class division where a small set of people control capital, the means by which to carry out production. So first of all, control over the means of production. Yes, money and big accumulations of money is one form that capital can take, but capital can go through all kinds of shapes, right? It can be invested, right? But you still have capital. If you have land, that's still capital. It's fixed capital is the technical term. So anyway, capitalism requires class striation, where a small group of people are in positions of control and most people are in positions of want. We have been proletarianized. And because we are proletarianized, we have no choice but to prostitute ourselves daily for wages. And we do work that we would not do otherwise, and we spend time that we would rather spend with our families and so on at work because we don't have any choice. And the purpose of this usage of the majority of the population in work is to produce more capital. Right? We are being exploited, meaning that, like, all the useful stuff that comes from our labor doesn't belong to us. Go back and check out that Marx thing about alienation if this is not familiar. And that surplus value, to use Marx's term, passes back into the hands of the owners who are thereby enriched. So the harder we work, the stronger they get and the worse our situation gets. That's internally. Now, there is a kind of natural process of resistance, which seems to occur in capitalist countries, and it gets bigger and it gets powerful, and then it gets shut down by state forces, which serve the capitalists, depending on historical circumstances. That's like union movements, right? Labor movements. It happens objectively in history. It happens that big populations of workers start to realize that their interests and the interests of the owners are really different, and that they can exert some influence over their own situation by acting collectively, by organizing themselves and acting collectively, and even engaging in struggle and in strikes, and in the most extreme instances, even like firefights and stuff, in order to improve situations. But generally speaking, union movements, labor movements, they have often included and even been led by revolutionary elements that had the goal of really transforming the society so there wouldn't be these classes anymore. And a simple way to think about that is, like, you know, instead of carrying out union work in order to get better wages and have safer working conditions, if your real goal in labor struggle is to take over the means of production altogether and have worker run, worker owned economic situations, that's a revolutionary goal, right? Like, that's what I'm for. That makes sense to me. But most labor movements, most union consciousness, as Lenin puts it, most union consciousness never gets past, like, hey, if we band together and push, we can get paid better. Now, this ties back to imperialism. So, okay, what's imperialism? Imperialism is just capitalism operating outside its borders. And one of the reasons that capital, these big deposits of money that are going to be deployed to make more money, and really these amount to power, right? One of the reasons that they turn outward, it's because of their internal worker labor movements, right? So when you have a place like the United States where a labor movement grows and becomes very powerful from, say, the late 1800s up till the middle 1900s, that means that the conditions for capital accumulation are getting worse. Because when these unions make gains, their gains cost the bosses money, right? So like the minimum wage, the basic wage that is being paid will be influenced by the labor movement. And across time, when a labor movement is successful, the wage is going to go up. That means that the costs to the capitalist are going up. That means that the capital accumulation, which is the whole purpose of production in a capitalist system, is going down. So this incentivizes capitalists to turn to the outside and to see, can we just dominate some external nations that are militarily, say, less evolved and that don't have, or just, they're just less armed, they're less powerful, and that don't have a labor movement, and that have, like, you know, a governmental apparatus which will suppress a labor movement, or we could put one in place, right? So this is how Lenin and Du Bois saw imperialism getting going. Like, as capital stops being able to make as much money as it would like, and it's always having this problem. This is called a crisis of capital accumulation. It then turns toward the outside. So imperialism is just capitalism turned toward the third world. So in the late 1800s, all of Africa, the very late 1800s, this happens super fast, from like 1880 to 1900, there's a shift. My numbers are approximate. They're always approximate. You know, don't hold me to exact numbers, but the basic, you know, thing is real. That in 1880, it's something like 10% of African territory was held and controlled by European interests. Now, of course, they had decimated, in a lot of ways, African society through the slave trade, but they weren't, like, occupying Africa in 1850, for the most part. Between 1880 and 1900, the shift goes from something like 10% to about 95% of African territory being controlled by European colonial powers. They call it the rush for Africa. And both Du Bois and Lenin thought that it was that rush for Africa, which involved European nations like Belgium and France and England taking huge portions of Africa, that eventually led those different countries, Germany too, into conflict with one another. World War I starts in Africa, according to this analysis. And it happens because the capitalist blocs in these different, associated with these different nation states, are out to maximize their profits by exploiting maximally the world's population, taking all the resources that are available in Africa by force, and taking among the key thing among those resources, labor supplies, using the labor of African people for their own benefit. They're really into it. It seems great to them until they run out of stuff to take and they run into one another. And then we get world war as a tragedy, a catastrophe impacting the entire globe, but really stemming from the insatiable greed of a few centers of capital in the global north. So one of the things that drives towards imperialism is internal labor movements or other factors that lead to lack of capital accumulation. And then recognize there really is a period of colonization by Europe, right? This is not made up. And it goes in different waves. You have the Spanish-led early colonialism, which is really oriented towards things like gold and silver, mining operations. And then you get another wave in the 16 through 1800s, where the biggest powers now are like France and England, which are much more about the seizure of territory and occupation. So you get the white settler colonies in this period, which are agriculturally based in a lot of cases. So like the slave trade gets going in exchange with the Caribbean, where Caribbean islands, first of all, the Taino people are just destroyed. And then there's this import of African people to work like the island of that was called Hispaniola, which is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic, to work that land and produce sugar cane. And sugar cane, for a while, Hispaniola is the most valuable colonial asset in the world because of its tremendous productive capacity for world agricultural markets. And of course, there's a bunch of famous commodities that then enter into this ever-expanding global market and that are being produced in colonial territories. So tobacco and coffee and sugarcane. So colonization really happened, right? And we had in the late 1800s the colonization of Africa. And then post-World War II, we have all these liberation movements, right? And how does that happen? For one thing, I mean, of course, we could spend, a whole PhD on trying to understand how we got from 1930 to 1980 and these changes in the way that powerful nations control other nations. But roughly speaking, it seems to be a part of the picture that all these colonial powers got super weakened through World War I and especially through World War II. And by the end of World War II, you have independence movements all over the colonized world through the 1950s. So Vietnam liberates itself, right? And we don't, in the United States, we're led to believe that the Vietnamese War was just about the U.S., playing global cop and like backing off communism. And somehow we were fighting a defensive war, just like in Korea. We were being defensive of the United States on the other side of the world by occupying and bombing these other people's country. like Americans are really easily duped because we don't ask about anything because we don't know where anything is and we don't know anything about history. They've taught us to not think. But if you really start looking, the picture changes really fast, right? The war in Vietnam is an anti-colonial war. The Vietnamese first fight the French, and the U.S. is backing the French with money and guns. And then the French at Dien Bien Phu are defeated by the Vietnamese, big inspiration for other revolutionary movements like in Algeria, for example. And then the United States comes in and fights part two of this colonial war, trying to hold on to that territory and that labor supply and ultimately failing, right? So there are all these independence movements which push the colonizers out globally between 1945 and 1975. And Nkrumah is riding right in this period. But his point is that imperialism can operate via direct colonialism, by settling people in Rhodesia, by settling like Boers in South Africa, and setting up just like white power states where black people are, native people are condemned to live in ghettos. And this really happens, and your country is a part of it, right? The United States supported South Africa, always did. But there are other forms by which this control can exist, too. So that's his book on neocolonialism, right? Neocolonialism is the next form of control that comes after colonialism. Once places like Kenya push the British out, right? Through the Mau Mau Rebellion, they pushed the British out. But instead of really getting liberated, what happens, this is Ngugi wa Thiong'o, puts it this way. He's a Kenyan writer. He says, you know, the British left through the front door. Everybody saw them pushed out. There was much celebration. Black people were put in positions of power. And then they came right back in through the back door. And it turns out that the black people in positions of power weren't just any Kenyans. They were the favorite Kenyans of the British, the ones who had previously managed their operations, right? So now they have their people in charge, but they're black faces. So it's less obvious what's going on. We don't have a settler base anymore. We have an indirect control over all these nations, right? So this brings us up to the picture that he's trying to draw, the contemporary situation of imperialism, which he, as a revolutionary leader, attempting to establish independence and self-determination for his people, is confronted with. He's like, in order to fight, and what he's involved in is, same thing Frantz Fanon was involved in, is attempting to build like a pan-African, Africa-wide coalition to fight against the capitalist world, which is led at this point by the United States. World War II makes the United States into the global imperial leader because it's the one that doesn't get the hell beat out of it in World War II. It's the one whose industrial base is grown exponentially, producing what we now know as the military-industrial complex. It's the one that gets to repattern Europe even and Japan in the aftermath of World War II and Europe via the Marshall Plan. The United States, and it's the one that holds on to its military bases around the world. So in the 1960s, we're probably still talking about a couple thousand military bases. Today, it's still 850. The United States has military positioning all over the world, which is just the inertial continuation of its positioning in World War II. And we see the fault lines established. Here's a parenthesis. We see the fault lines established in World War II on fire today. Ukraine is still that fault line between the Western powers and the socialist powers, right? NATO did indeed creep eastward across the years 1989 to the present. And it's still those Western powers pushing against what I would just describe as another center of capital associated with another fascist nation state, Russia. And then we can also see their conflict in Syria, and we can see their conflict in Taiwan. The lines between these actors that become the centers of power at the end of World War II are still the fault lines threatening world war today, because capital accumulation in these different centers, China, Russia, Western Europe and the United States, is in a bunch of ways already world war, because those centers are endlessly voracious. They don't ever achieve balance. It's never enough. They're always pushing outwards. But we're at the center of the nation state, which pushes furthest outwards and hardest. So anyway, go back to Africa or any colonial world, or post-colonial world, neo-colonial world, but Africa, because that's where Nkrumah is writing from. And he says this new form of domination is called neo-colonialism. And it's not just that like there are client governments, is one way to put it, or puppet governments, client regimes and puppet governments. Puppet government is where like you have a government in charge, they look like they are independent, but really their strings are pulled from behind. Right, like so. Look at like Belarus and Lukashenko. Looks like Lukashenko's always been Putin's man, right? And Russia pulls the strings, and Lukashenko dances. And Belarus is now asking to have Russian nukes placed in Belarus. Not really, because the Belarusian people have spoken. They have been spoken for. People have spoken in their name, and the people who spoke in their name was a dude who worked for some other guy who's way more powerful in a way more powerful neighboring country. Right. And then ask yourself, who's Zelensky? Right. Is Zelensky really an independent operator, or is he beholden in thousands of ways to the collective West, even before he was dependent upon them for his war machine? Right. You know, is the Ukrainian army really the only military force that is fighting Russia in Ukraine? Or is it really NATO in the background that is fighting a proxy war? Right, like this proxy thing where you have bigger forces in the background acting through intermediaries is a feature of neocolonialism. Right. So there's an internal enemy to capitalism, which is the labor movement. There's an external enemy to capital, which are revolutionary and independence movements. And imperialism itself seems to be a response in part to internal labor movements. And it answers that problem, too. Like, what happens through imperial action? You bring a lot more money into the imperialist country, and then you can pay those higher wages to a bunch of people in the imperialist country and keep them comfortable and quiet. But what is it that's really buying them off? It's the exploitation of the third world. That's the situation in which we find ourselves today. And if you look across the map, you will not find any countries that are, or very few, Cuba these days, Brazil maybe, to some extent, with Lula. But it's very hard to find countries that are actually independent. What you will find much more frequently is countries that are in, I think the contemporary language is like in the zone of influence of a particular country. Countries that are under the influence of China, right? Like North Korea is, you know, it's its own country, but it wouldn't be its own country if China wasn't right there, right? And when China wants something, North Korea probably is going to have to respond, right? Similarly, for all kinds of places all over the world that will be the... they have special relationships with the United States, for example, or with France. Take Mali and France. Mali was previously a French colony. Now it is neocolonially controlled by France, or at least it has these working relations, right? And what does that mean? It means that there are military bases for the previous colonial powers or for the imperialist powers in these countries. Like my wife's family is from Bulgaria. There are NATO bases all over Bulgaria. Right, like Bulgaria used to be under the influence of the USSR and was really controlled in that way. But post-Cold War, it comes under the influence of the IMF, the World Bank, and NATO. Right, so there are a bunch of American military bases in Bulgaria. That's not neutral, right? There will be special agreements between the puppet government or the client government and the military of the imperial power. And often what they'll do is they'll set up like counterinsurgency police forces. So take like, you know, like the period 1953 to 1979 in Iran. Iran had been an English colonial asset. In 1953, there's a nationalization movement led by a guy named Mossadegh. He was going to, so nationalization means like take back the things that foreign countries had been controlling, like the oil fields, take that back from, I forget what it's called, it's like Anglo-American or something like that. Take it back from the English country company that is controlling those resources. This happens all over the place. Look through Central America through the 1970s and the 1980s. Look at Chile in 1973. Allende leads a nationalization movement. The United States and the CIA conspire to assassinate him and carry out a military coup through which Chile is recolonized, right? Like its assets are put back in the hands of northern capital. So there exist neo-colonial relationships, and they have economic dimensions, and they have political dimensions, and they have military dimensions. And this is reality. And if you really want to understand like what's going on across the globe, you have to know these things. Like that's what an educated person really ought to know. And if you want to believe that this is not true, I don't know, you know, try and convince me. If you give me good arguments, I'll respect it. But I think this is a fact about the world. You know, there are more and less powerful nations, and power isn't just like abstract. It's concrete. It's really manifested. So then let's finish up by pointing out what Nkrumah points out, which is that this control over territories that is held by the most powerful imperial countries is not only military, and it's not only political, and it's not even only economic. It has all those dimensions, but it's also like cultural and ideological. So the same thing that is happening to us in the United States as we are hit by all this news, you know, and as we're hit by school curriculums, which are non-neutral, which are selected, right? Like the media flows are selected, and the stories that are there even in popular media are very specific, And you don't really get much media or very many movies that are totally opposed to the interests of the capitalists who own movie production facilities. They don't make things that indict themselves, right? So you're getting this selection, this pro-capitalist selection, and we're being hit by it all the time. You know, all about success, all about money, all about individualism, all about competition, right? American, Western, capitalist values. We're being hit by them all the time, but so is Africa, right? So it's not just the home country. It's not just our situation. The same kind of propaganda is going on with respect to Africa. And how does this happen? It happens because the media production ability is much greater in the global capitalist North, and because powerful countries like the United States make agreements with neocolonial regimes to be the main or even the sole provider of news and cultural programming. So think, what does that mean? Like, to grow up in Africa, only watching, like, or primarily or largely watching American media, what does that lead you to think about yourself as a black person or as an African? What does that lead you to think about Africa in general versus the North? Doesn't it, like, make you start to think that the real world is up north, or that, like, certain countries like the United States are more advanced than yours? And maybe you're thinking, well, but they are. But, like, who defines advanced, right? Notice how this control over the cultural sphere and the control over the distribution of propaganda, of media, of all forms, gives access to the psychology and the understanding of the subject population. This is happening not just in particular countries that have class rule and therefore control over the means of the production and distribution of ideas. It's also happening globally. Now, I'll just finish up by reiterating what Nkrumah says are a few of the key things that are being carried out by this propaganda. And he says there's straight out psychological warfare, and especially if there are independence movements or revolutionary movements, there will be systematic attacks upon them, right? But, like, if we look at what's being done, according to him, in Africa in 1968, I think we can see some similarities with what's going on with us. And maybe this should lead us further to question, you know, who we are and who are our allies. I really like that Malcolm X-style reasoning that says we should really be reaching out beyond these borders and finding that there are huge populations all over the world that are in the same situation as us, because then we can strategize from a position of power instead of from a position of weakness. I think we should be doing that. And also, maybe we can just sort of educate ourselves about some of the stuff that's being done to us. He calls this psychological warfare, right? So there's an attempt to convince rebels, or convince the general population, that the rebels can't win, that you're super outgunned, that y'all can't lead yourself because there are experts elsewhere who know a whole lot more than you do. And so you ought to just shut up and let the experts decide. Don't get, like, all fancy thinking that you can run things. Trying to convince people, this is related to that Nietzsche lecture, which I actually just did a second ago. Trying to convince people that, you know, you're peaceful people. You're a Christian people. You turn the other cheek. You don't want to be involved with these violent, you know, fill in your rebel movement here, right? You know, these violent members of the PAIGC in Western Africa, or these members of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, right? Like, you don't want to be have anything to do with them. They're violent, but you're good Christians, right? So they're playing on all these pre-existent value structures and trying to manipulate them. They're also, like, when there are, this is true domestically and internationally, when there are rebel movements, there's a systematic move to divide them and to say, hey, look, here's a few people, Martin Luther King, who are good rebel leaders, because they're civilized and they are rational, and we can talk to them, and we're going to do it too, because we're just, like, you know, good people, and we're not really mean like everybody says. We'll talk to them because we're progressive and civilized and blah, blah, blah. The ones that we can't talk to are the ones that we're calling extremists and terrorists. And really think about that, right? Who determines who gets called an extremist and a terrorist, right? Like Malcolm X, extremist and terrorist. Kwame Nkrumah, extremist and terrorist. These other people are extremists and terrorists. And, you know, by definition, somebody who's an extremist is irrational. And by definition, someone who's irrational can't be dealt with through discourse and reason. You just got to bomb them. That's all there is to it. Right. So those kinds of techniques of dividing the movement and producing one part that will be acceptable, the ones that the regime can best work with, and then systematically attacking the other one and trying to get everybody to be alienated from and to accept the destruction of this movement is achieved by propagandistic means. So divide and conquer techniques, right? And also pacification ones that, like, you know, you shouldn't fight because it's not good. You're not bad people, right? Meanwhile, of course, this is super duplicitous because the United States military is using force every which way, right? And the local puppet regime is using counterinsurgency. Oh, sorry, you know, I forgot. I was talking about Iran. So in Iran in 1953, Mossadegh carries out this nationalization project or offers it and gets elected to office on the basis of it because he's very popular. What happens? He is assassinated and the Shah is put in charge, and the Shah is provided with a lethal police force called Savak. And Savak carries out counterinsurgency. Like, it systematically looks for any rebels and it tortures them extensively and imprisons people extensively. And it turns out that the severity of the action of Savak under the Shah is one of the main reasons that you get the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, because one of the ways that neocolonialism works is by setting up hyper-repressive state apparatuses in the client territory to keep all the movements that might change this client relationship where Iran works for England, to keep everybody who would threaten that destroyed, tortured, intimidated, and so on. So there's psychological warfare being carried out against the whole population, and there's military suppression being carried out against anybody who's actually actively trying to challenge the situation of power. The psychological campaigns includes things like, you know, just look how beautiful the West is. Look at all these things that we've got. Look at, like, how sexy the women are. Look at how buff the men are. Look at how awesome our cars are. Look at how much fun we have, like, with our endless, like, we have every kind of food that you could ever want to eat and every kind of liquor that you could ever want to have and every kind of sweets that kids would ever like and every kind of, like, outfit that you could ever look super, super drippy in, you know? Like, just this constant parading of Western culture as the only good culture, the only progressive culture, this constant reaffirmation of capitalist society and capitalist economics as the only good and valid economics, and suggesting that the West are the experts of this best progressive system. So the constant propagandistic psychological attack upon the population and their thinking, and then also this constant suggestion that, like, but your people are more backwards. And you don't have the expertise. You don't have the technical knowledge that we have. And that's why you need to let our advisors into your country and let us direct you. That's why you need to let our, like in Chile in 1973 when Pinochet takes power, this big wave of economic advisors from the University of Chicago is brought in. And they set up this thing that they call the BRIC, this huge book that specifies what needs to happen in Chile. It's not the Chilean people who are deciding. It's not even Pinochet who's deciding. It is these experts from the U.S. They're Chilean, mostly Chilean people, but who went and studied in the U.S. These experts, and behind them all, Milton Friedman, their leader, an American neoliberal, who get to determine how are Chilean resources used? How is Chilean labor to be used? How is Chilean tax money to be distributed or not distributed? What kind of, you know, public housing ought to exist or not? All these choices that affect everybody on the ground are being made from a distance, but there's a propaganda which justifies it, saying that, well, y'all are too backwards, and the people up north, they're the ones who really know, right? Okay, so I think that's the picture. If you read over the Nkrumah, you can get a lot more details. I think that the man is fascinating and beautiful. And just think about, like, okay, that's 1968. How does this map onto the present? What are the relationships of client states and imperialist powers today? And what can we learn from the critique of propaganda and psychological warfare that Nkrumah is giving us? To what extent can we take his analysis and apply it to our circumstance and find things that are real?